This is the Monday Morning Quarterback Podcast with Andy Benoit and your host, John Engel.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the MMQB Podcast with Andy Benoit. I'm John Engel at Engel's Angle on Twitter. You can follow Andy at Andy_Benoit. Make it easy on yourself. Subscribe to the podcast, MMQB Podcast on iTunes. It'll be in your inbox every Thursday morning. Defensive end from the Buffalo Bills, Jerry Hughes, was all scheduled to be on the program, but he wasn't able to do that. Everything's shut down there in Buffalo. And Andy, you're a little under the weather. We won't spend too much time on that, but excuse the
goal
the
is to get through,
in your voice.
Yeah, get through the whole show, which would be about 60 minutes, we're hoping. And I have not spoken in 3 days. I mean, I have not talked. It's actually been kind of, I have 26 voicemails backed up because I can't call, you know, what am I going to do?
That's dedication, folks. But first of all, we'll start off with the Patriots. They're hosting the Detroit Lions, and the Patriots are now atop many people's power rankings. Their latest victory came on the strength of their ground game in Jonas Gray, which we all saw coming Sunday night at Indy.
Yeah.
He had 199 yards, and that was changed to 201 yards on the ground and 4 touchdowns. Do you see the Patriots becoming more of this kind of power running team, especially starting with this Lions defense, which has been great against the run?
Yeah, I'm real curious to see how they play it this week, because Detroit is not an easy team to run against. You know, New England's done this before. This is not necessarily brand new. Now, what we saw them do against Indianapolis that they haven't done a lot of, other than in week 2 against Minnesota, was go to that 6 offensive linemen look. And they ran behind that consistently. And it wasn't just that they had 6 O linemen on the field. They were running behind those 6 offensive linemen. And they were including, when they weren't doing that, they were including their tight ends in the blocking scheme and getting double teams at the point of attack. I mean, it was a power running game to the truest form. I don't know if that's the way to go at Detroit or not. I think it's tough to do that against Ndamukong Suh. Even C.J. Mosley, their other defensive tackle, I think it can be tough to do that against. But, you know, Detroit is a little bit more of a finesse front 7, so maybe they feel they could do it. Indianapolis is exceptionally vulnerable to the run at points like this, and I think New England felt that going into that game. My guess is if they do want to run the ball a bunch against Detroit, and I'm not convinced they will, but if they do, I would see them doing more Shane Vereen type, not all the way, but multi-directional stuff to get the Lions linebackers and use their speed against them. You want to get Detroit flowing one way and cut back against them another way.
I want to get your take on this, because we've talked about these running formations, which doesn't necessarily, or running teams, doesn't necessarily mean the team is running the ball a ton, but these running base formations.
Yeah.
The Patriots are equipped for that in a lot of their plays, because you see those tight end sets, right? So you can be kind of deceptive with those tight ends now. Is that something we might see?
Well, deceptive, and you mean moving the tight ends around, or what do you mean with deception?
Well, I mean, instead of putting that extra offensive lineman, just having those tight ends in place, and now you don't know whether it is going to be power running or to a guy like Gronkowski.
Well, Gronkowski gives them that flexibility as well, and that's a unique element of his game that's not looked at enough, is that he can be a point of attack or in line, as they call it, in line blocking tight end if you need him to be. He's a very good blocker. He's also excellent on the move, and he likes to block on the move. And I remember, I don't know if it was against Detroit, but something that I think they'll do against Detroit that will get Gronkowski on the move, I think it was against Detroit, but these trap blocks against Ndamukong Suh, because Suh is so quick off the snap that what a lot of teams like to do, and San Francisco's had success with this as well against Detroit over the years, is let him get penetration initially, and then it's actually more of a wham block, and then bring the tight end on the backside and cream him there. And I could see them doing something like that with Gronkowski. Now, that's something you can't necessarily do with a 6th offensive lineman, because those guys aren't mobile enough. So, yeah, I don't think we'll see the 6-0 line stuff as much. I think if they do run, it'll be Gronkowski. Or we could see them – the other thing is Detroit's a nickel defense. You could spread them out and run against their 6-man box if you want.
This Patriots offense, too, is 2nd in the league in scoring, while Detroit is 26. They're 7-3, but they're not scoring a lot.
No, it's been on the strength of the defense. And, you know, the offense is inconsistent in that you don't know what you're getting from the running game from week to week with them. That's partly the Reggie Bush factor. You know, he leads the league in like 1 week injuries, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He's got that Vince Carter syndrome a little bit, where I've never heard a guy so often be out one Sunday but declare himself ready to go the following Sunday. Reggie Bush does that a lot. So he did that last game, if I recall. You know, I think whoever throws the ball best will win this game, actually, John, the more I think about it.
And that could
I don't think – I think Detroit, obviously, is their passing team. They have the weapons there. And I think New England's going to be more of a passing team this week as well.
Two teams that are looking up at New England, Miami in the AFC East, and Denver looking to grab that top seed in the AFC. Andy, you wrote this week that Miami has the best defense in the AFC. Go into that a little bit.
Well, I just kind of – I did something that you and I tried to avoid on this podcast, but I went through the players and just started listing guys and saying, this guy's good, this guy's good, here's how he's good. They've got a lot of players. I mean, it starts with that. The defensive line is one that can dictate matchups and dictate the terms of engagement against in both the running game and against the pass. Their linebackers have gotten a lot better. Jenkins, especially, as a stacked linebacker, and they've been using him more as a blitzer, and I think he's decent in coverage. Koamisi has not come off the field lately. He's been good transitioning to the inside. But what's really put this defense in a new class has been the return of Rashad Jones at safety. And I don't know what got into him or if it's just a comfort thing being in the scheme under Kevin Coyle for a third year. I think Jones was a guy they were maybe even considering replacing at one point in the offseason. He's having the best season of his career. He's having a Pro Bowl caliber year. And he came back from the suspension. He's out four games for a PED violation. But he's come back, and he's shown tremendous range. He's been flexible, versatile, range against the run and the pass. And in the past, he's always had those skills, but they haven't translated to good play. He's been a talent guy, but not necessarily a good player. He's now learning to apply his talents to the context of the scheme as well as play with improvisational instincts. And you put that kind of a safety along with Luis Delmas, who's not bad, but then with those corners, Grimes and Finnegan, that's a good secondary. That's a secondary that can play any kind of coverage and match up to most teams.
Well, and that's the second-best ranked defense in the NFL right now behind Detroit. And these teams, Detroit and Miami, kind of have some parallels, don't they?
Well, they're fast and they
grounded by that defense.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, oh, you mean talking about the whole teams?
Yeah,
I was thinking the defenses have some parallels, especially.
Well, when you were – sorry to interrupt you, but when you were describing Detroit and saying with this New England team, whoever throws it best will win that game, that's kind of how it feels like with Miami. Is that – it has to be
because Denver cannot run the ball one iota right now, and this is not the week to get your running game on track. I mean, Denver right now, next to Indianapolis, is the worst over the last 3 weeks. I don't know what the stats say, but – they're the worst rushing team in the NFL behind Indianapolis over the last 3 weeks. They just don't have a running game. And Miami's tough to run against. John, the reason Miami and Detroit, where the parallels really are there and why they're the top of the class and the rankings, they have the two best. It's 1 and 1A for defensive lines in the NFL. You could argue Buffalo's in that discussion as well.
Is that what you saw when you said preseason that this Miami team could win 11 games? Because that's one of the predictions you were right on.
Yeah, well.
So far, we'll see.
Yeah, I mean. You know, you're going to – predictions are a crap shot either way.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it is one of the things I saw. And I like the scheme as well. I like that – and I guess they have been in the scheme for a third year, and I think that is making an impact. I think guys are more comfortable. And the scheme, to clarify, it's Kevin Coyles, who came over from Cincinnati, and they do a lot of those Mike Zimmer, now Paul Gunther-type Bengal things with double A-gap pressures and variations of that.
So what about Denver? What did St. Louis do last week that Miami can hope to replicate here?
Well, St. Louis, you know, they really beat Denver on both sides of the ball. That offense did not get into the red zone against the Rams. Now, the Rams had a very good pass rush. Ryan Clady had his hands full against Robert Quinn. Every guy's going to do that against Quinn. Clady this week will not be going up against that kind of edge rusher. He'll have Olivier Vernon, who's very good. He's not Robert Quinn. But they're going to have to pass protect better. Denver has a new center in Will Montgomery, and there were some pressure concepts that St. Louis did that really put Montgomery in a bind, and that also included Robert Quinn looping around on long stunts. We could see Miami do some kind of version of that. And then I thought the Rams are very good in zone coverage. I thought they'd play more man coverage because, I don't know, I guess you really can't play man coverage against Denver, as we've talked about. But they did a lot of pressure stuff and zone coverage. And it was just good fundamental sound football. But what they had working for them was defensive speed, and that's something else that Miami has. Now, having said that, do we really think Denver's going to have back-to-back awful games and with the second one coming at Mile High?
Well, and a lot of that had to do with Peyton Manning not having all of his toys healthy. I mean, Emmanuel Sanders going out early in that second half and Julius Thomas not being there. And Wes Welker just, you know, Wes Welker hasn't been a whole lot of a big factor.
You're right. He hasn't been the same. I think he's had under 300 yards.
He's hit a lot.
He does, and you're right. That offense did change, especially Julius Thomas when he was out. Jacob Tammy's a big drop-off, and where you really saw it was when Tammy aligned as an ex-ISO receiver, and they tried to stretch the field with him. He did not win. He had a couple of throws to him. He didn't win or really come close to winning on either of them. It was the less flexible Broncos offense. You couple that with the running game that wasn't working, and the team lost the game. On the other side of the ball, then, you know, the Rams got 4 yards, it seemed like, on every single first down carry. Miami's going to have a different approach. You're not a run pass type team. They'll mix it up, but I think where the game will be decided is that other side of the ball. If the Dolphins defense can keep the Broncos in check there, then, you know, the Dolphins offense will have a shot at it. But I don't see Miami coming out and outscoring Denver with that offense they have.
Staying out west, but going over to the NFC, the Cardinals visit the Seahawks. A year ago, Arizona won this game in Seattle. How did that happen? And do you think this can happen again? I think that's the big question here.
Well, last year, Seattle did not play their best game. They were not playing their best down the stretch. I know it sounds weird because they won the Super Bowl, but people forget Seattle during the regular season was not great on offense. And Arizona's a man-to-man team, and last year they stifled Seattle's receivers in man-to-man, and they stifled them so well. Carson Palmer had 4 interceptions.
Yeah, which is amazing that you still win that game.
In Seattle, they won it. And Stanton might give them some opportunities for similar plays, other interceptions. I mean, I watched him against Detroit. He threw with tremendous decisiveness in that game, but a couple times, 2 of them, he threw right to the other team, which tells you he was predetermining some of those throws out of the huddle. And you're not going to be able to do that against Seattle because they'll get a beat on those tendencies and they'll pick you off. But maybe that's not a big deal because Seattle's wide receivers cannot separate from man coverage still right now. And Daryl Bevel, Seahawks fans have been very hard on him as their offensive coordinator. I think he's a good coach. He needs to do more man beater concepts in their passing game though. There's too many isolation routes with spreading out and hoping that Russell Wilson can make a play. And that's just that. It's not great football. I think you can help your guys out and give them some defined reads.
And in that game last season, the Cardinals were able to greatly limit that Seattle Seahawks running game, 18 carries and 71 yards for Marshawn Lynch. What do you make of Marshawn Lynch this last week or so? And what's been going
drama?
On there with the $100,000 fine now with the total? What's going on there? What do you think of Lynch?
I mean, I don't care about that media stuff, whether he talks to the media or not. I get why he has to. I mean, I understand that because the NFL's a business and the media spreads the word, and that's your outreach to the fans. As far as on the field, he's playing great, and he's a lot more elusive than people realize, and he still has the quickness, the elusiveness. He runs hard. I think they like him in that offense. They definitely need him because neither of those other running backs, Christine Michael or Robert Turbin, neither of those guys are ready to be the feature guy or even get 20 carries in a game right now. Maybe they could do it for 1 week or something. But Marshawn Lynch is that offense. And the reason they were able to limit him last year in Arizona, for one, it's a good defense. I mean, Arizona's run defense is also
in Seattle, you mean?
Excuse me. Arizona is able to limit him in Seattle. It's a good run defense that Arizona has, but they dedicated a guy against Russell Wilson on the read options and then did a good job of dialing in on Lynch from there. And that's the way you have to play Seattle because they have been stressing teams a lot ever since that Giants game where they destroyed New York 2 weeks ago. They've been stressing teams with the read option.
That Sunday night game, the Cowboys are coming off a bye. Giants are coming off that 6-point home loss to the 49ers in which Eli Manning had 5 interceptions. Andy, you've said before that a lot of Eli's interceptions last year were not actually his fault and came off of those tip balls. How about this last Sunday?
I think the issues were about more than just Eli. He did not play a good game, obviously. But the Giants' offense was not in sync. Guys were not consistently getting open within the context of the play designs. A lot of that has to do with Reuben Randall, who has not been consistent in the least bit this season or really in his career. And when you're not getting open within the context of the play designs, the offense is going to lose structure and lack rhythm. And they didn't have some great play calling at times in that game either. I mean, some of the red zone play calling was 4 consecutive fade balls at one point. I mean, take what you want from that. 49ers are a good defense. You can't do that kind of thing against a good defense. Cowboys do not have a defense like the Niners, but they have one that is capable of making you pay for your mistakes, because the Cowboys have been very fundamentally sound and very comfortable within their scheme. And when guys are fundamentally sound and comfortable in their scheme, they play faster and they too can make plays.
This seems kind of crazy talking about a guy that's been the cornerstone of that franchise for 11 years now, but a lot of people are talking about, should the Giants be concerned about the viability of their quarterback long-term now?
I don't think so, because we've seen Eli go through these peaks and valleys before, and a lot of the valleys have had ancillary issues or you know, side issues attached to them, whether it's guys not playing well, offensive line troubles, inconsistent running game, whatever. And Eli's style of play, for a variety of reasons, I think is going to sometimes exacerbate those existing issues. Now, on the flip side, his style of play, and what we're talking about, is his willingness to throw late in the down with bodies around him, his willingness to take chances, fit balls through tight windows, all that stuff. While that might exacerbate negative issues, and an example would be a receiver is out of sync, he runs his route a fraction of a second offbeat, and all of a sudden Eli Manning throws a pick because of that. On the flip side, that also can make the big plays. I mean, we've seen that before, and we've seen this team get hot and Eli be a big part of that. And his playmaking prowess has been a big part of that. So I don't think, I mean, if you go out and find another quarterback, you're not going to find one as good as Eli Manning. He's 33 years old. He's got plenty of time left. He's never missed a game, I don't think. He knows how to protect himself. So it's not a case of a guy losing arm strength or getting old. It's just he's made a little bit more magnified versions of some of the mistakes that he's lived with throughout his career.
With timing offenses like the Giants, I was just thinking about this while you were explaining Manning, is it easier for the defense if they can sniff out that play earlier to know where that timing is going to be? It seems like it's more scripted.
Yeah, perhaps. And they're not as timing-based as they used to be. The new system under McAdoo, they're a little more, it's supposed to be that Packers system, which has a little bit more room for breathing room, but that's at the intermediate levels in the passing game. Underneath, on the quick timing passing game, which is also a huge part of what they do, and they're doing it more than the Packers have been doing it now, that is timing-based. But I don't know. Every offense, John, every play design, you know, I'm making too much of this. Every play design has timing involved. There's none that other than the Hail Mary where you just draw it up and say, you go here, or you go in this area, and we'll throw it in that area. The Giants have always had very specific route principles, though. And the receivers have not always adhered to them.
Washington on the road at the San Francisco 49ers this week. We've talked at length about the Niners this season. Washington, though, what do they have to do to avoid from going to 3-8? What's Jay Gruden got to go?
The defense. I mean, we can talk RG3 all we want. I did a thing on him this week, so.
And we don't want.
Yeah, I mean, we did last week. I think he's leaving plays on the field, and I think that locker room does have some issues in part because of that. Defensively, they have to fix some things, clean some things up. They got exposed in man-to-man coverage, or not man-to-man, really. It was just isolation coverage against Tampa Bay last week. Those big Buccaneer receivers, Mike Evans.
Mike Evans had a day.
Yeah, he did, and it was against Breland. He had one against Breland and Clark, who played a two-cover concept just horribly for the 34-yard touchdown. The 56-yard touchdown was an example of the downside of some of Jim Haslett's schemes. Haslett's a great coach, but when you are such a gambler, you roll the dice, sometimes they don't come up favorably for you. And on that 56-yard touchdown, they wound up with Perry Riley as the only defender who could possibly pick up Mike Evans, and they were running full speed down the field. And you can guess who wins that foot race. And by the way, Riley was coming from the line of scrimmage double A-gap position. So he also had – Evans had a running start, a head start on him. Just they rolled the dice and it didn't work out. And they got beat on some cover zero blitzes. That kind of thing they need to clean up against San Francisco. Now, I don't think – I'm not saying you need to reduce that, because I'm thinking about how do you want to play Colin Kaepernick. And that kind of thing also can make Kaepernick go crazy. But something they think they want to do or need to do, they like to disguise a lot in Washington. I think it's some part of the disguise needs to present – imminent pressure to Kaepernick's face. I don't think you want to disguise coverage and bring pressure. I think you want to disguise pressure and either bring a version of it or go to coverage. Because when Kaepernick sees a defender coming and he sees pressure, he'll break down the play design almost immediately every time. He's a guy who you want him to see your blitz.
Isn't that a lot of what St. Louis did just a couple of weeks ago, and it was successful for them?
Yeah, the Rams did everything against them. I mean, they threw the whole gauntlet at them, and some of it they showed, some of it they faked. They had 8 sacks in that game, and they got them in a variety of ways, and they also confused Kaepernick's offensive line at times. That's what Washington will attempt to do, and I think they need to do it. And whatever you do, you want to make Kaepernick play fast in his head first. You don't want him playing fast physically because he's hard to catch. But if you can get him sped up and know that things are going to break down and then you have some kind of zone defenders behind it so you can keep some eyes on him, that's how you play this team.
Last week we saw the debut of Ryan Mallett, 20 of 30, 211 yards, 2 touchdowns, an interception. Not too bad statistically. What did you see from him on film as they prepare to take on the Cincinnati Bengals this week?
Yeah, he had some ups and downs. He missed some throws early in the game that were there that I'm sure he'd like to have back at the intermediate levels. Had chances for big plays that he just missed the throws on. That'll get corrected. That's not a huge deal because he was able to play crisply the rest of the game. They did a ton of 3-step timing with him, totally negated the Browns' pass rush with it, made things easy on their offensive line, made things easy on Mallett because it defined the throws because you're not going to – can't scan the whole field and confuse yourself on 3-step timing. And what really stood out overall, John, was how much more rhythmic that Texans offense looked with Mallett in there versus with Fitzpatrick. There was a play-to-play flow to the whole game, and they played up-tempo. They had over 80 plays run from scrimmage in that game, which is something else because they ran the ball on over 50 of them, I believe. And to run the ball on over 50 times and have 80 plays or whatever the numbers were, they ran the ball an insane amount. That keeps the clock moving. How did they get all those plays off? I mean, it was really impressive.
Well, and so you're satisfied with Bill O'Brien's choice to take out Ryan Fitzpatrick and go with Ryan Mallett?
Yeah, I understood it before this game and after watching Mallett against Cleveland, I understand it even more, and I think it's the move you make. I think Mallett's worth a look-see at this point, and again, the offense is more rhythmic with him in there anyway.
The Bengals were able to get that big win in the Superdome, which a lot of teams aren't able to do. Is this a good turning point for the Bengals going into this game, another difficult road matchup?
Well, they seem to have turning points throughout their season, don't they?
It does seem like that, doesn't it?
That's what happens when you faceplant against the Colts and then faceplant against the Browns. The bounce back against New Orleans was very impressive, and the way they did it was impressive. It was through sound execution on both sides of the ball. They had 3 excellent point-of-attack lead block run plays, counter weak runs. So start out one way, go back to the weak side the other way with the lead blocker, and it was Jeremy Hill behind Ryan Hewitt. Hewitt all 3 times got a body on David Hawthorne, who at sometimes was maybe trying to take on the block, so I'm not saying Hawthorne got destroyed or anything, but they were perfect execution, perfectly sound, and they had some of that in the passing game as well. Dalton was very good on fade balls to A.J. Green, which is the guy you want to be throwing fade balls to. And then on defense, they didn't do a lot of their Bengali blitz stuff, and that's probably because they were facing Drew Brees, but they dropped back and played a variety of coverages, mainly zone, and kept everything in front of them and forced the Saints to mount long drives. And the Saints were unable to sustain offense at the end of those drives. They couldn't cap off on them. I think we'll see a similar approach against Houston, although factor in more blitzes. And some of that has to do with, I don't know if Vontaze Burfict's ready to play or not, but when he comes back, we'll see more of their blitz scheme come back because a lot of it centers around linebackers. But let's say he's not in there this week. I think they can still do some of the blitzes with Vincent Ray in there and now that Ray Malauga's back in the lineup. And I think they'll do that and try to confuse Fitzpatrick. But if Houston's going to be playing this 3-step passing game, you don't want to be blitzing a whole lot.
Well, isn't that Texans offense a team that you can take a little more risks with?
Yeah.
On defense, that's what I mean with even with those timing routes and those quick releases.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Especially compared to New Orleans, because New Orleans, they have 5 progressions on every throw.
And the personnel to beat you.
Yeah, they do. And Houston has some play. I mean, Hopkins can get over the top. Yeah, Andre Johnson's not what he used to be, but he's still viable. He'll make you pay if you make a big mistake. But someone needs to test Ryan Mallett and see if he can. We know he can do the 3-step thing, but there will be some kind of situation. If you can get them in 3rd and long, which it was tough for Cleveland to do that because Houston played so fast. They got their run. When you play real fast and you run the ball effectively, you're almost bound to get 3 or 4 yards just because the defense is so reactionary. It's just human physics. We've seen New England do that to teams as well. Bill O'Brien probably learned this up-tempo running game from New England. So Cincinnati has to take that away and get them in third and long. And I'll be real curious to see how that goes because Domantas Peko and Ray Maluga both had their best games of the season last week against the run, and that was also a very big difference in that Saints game.
That AFC North is so wide open right now. Does that division look a little better because all of the teams seem to be playing pretty close to average? That way it seems
well,
so close.
I don't know if they're close to average. I mean, they're all over 500.
I know,
and
but
I believe they're all at least two games over 500.
I just don't think any of them are, well, from the outside.
There's no great team you're seeing. They're all good, not great. That's probably what you mean.
That's right. And that Browns team went from the king of the AFC North to bottom right after that game.
I know, and I go back and forth and waver. And, you know, Pittsburgh looks like, I think Browns will get better because their guys are coming back, Josh Gordon mainly. Pittsburgh, though, that defense will get healthy at some point. Baltimore, I'm worried about Jimmy Smith, but I don't want to rule him out. That AFC North, you're right, that is a hard division to figure. Cincinnati, I have to admit, and this might just be my own bias, I don't know why this is, but they're the one team all season I haven't considered as the possible champion, which probably means they're going to win it again.
Well, and then we have one of two AFC North versus NFC South games, and that's that Browns team on the road with the Falcons. Last week, Brian Hoyer was 20 of 50 in the loss at Houston. 20 of 50? You throw the ball 50 times? Is this... Are we ready to worry about Brian Hoyer just a little bit?
Not quite yet, because last week it was a combination. Browns did not execute very well, but Houston also had some great coverage against them. Some of their pressure designs worked. I think it was a perfect storm of a bad football game for Cleveland. I didn't get the sense that Brian Hoyer was getting exposed. Now, two things I would – caveats, if you will. One is they did not do a whole lot of moving pockets with Hoyer last week. They did have him just drop back and throw a little more. And that's a little bit concerning that they performed this poorly on what's a standard, fairly routine NFL tactic to drop back and throw. So maybe Hoyer and that whole passing game gets exposed a little bit there. But I think we'll see that again. I don't know if it'll be as big a deal because now that Josh Gordon's back, that changes the whole dynamic of the receiving core. The other thing, the other caveat, I mentioned who has the bad running games, Denver and Indianapolis right now.
That's right.
Cleveland's not far behind. I know Isaiah Crowell had decent
and
numbers.
And they released Ben Tate.
Well, Ben Tate wasn't doing anything.
No.
Ben Tate was their worst of three running backs. And so now it's Terrence West and it's Isaiah Crowell, who are two different style of backs at least. But they're still looking for answers in that running game. There has not been much consistency. And what was concerning is Houston had no fear of that rushing attack at all. They came out with two deep safeties and quarters coverage on a lot of plays. It's very hard to throw the ball against quarters coverage. That's one you tend to want to run more against. And Cleveland could not, you know, they didn't make them pay for that. Houston was comfortable not putting extra bodies anywhere near the line of scrimmage against them. I could see Atlanta doing the same kind of thing because Mike Nolan has always been comfortable with quarters coverage. Now, maybe less so this year, because he has not had William Moore, who is back. I don't know if he'll play this week, but he's back from his, I think it was a shoulder injury, whatever kept him out. If William Moore's in, he can run the alley really well. And so then you don't mind having your safeties back and two deep coverage because one of them can get his butt to the ball. I think we'll see Mike Nolan mimic is what I'm getting at. They'll mimic a lot of what Houston did because they have personnel that can do it and they're comfortable playing with quarters coverage concepts.
Well, and there might be even more stress on that Falcons secondary, especially with the loss of second-year cornerback Robert Alford. He has that broken wrist. Josh Gordon coming back, now you have a lot of stress on Desmond Trufant, right?
You do, and I think they'll have Trufant follow Gordon. And well, there's one of two ways. I think you have to put a safety on Gordon, a safety help. Now, do you want to put your best corner on him as well and then burn your safety and your best corner, or do you want to try your luck with either whoever it'll be, Josh Wilson, Robert McClain, whoever they decide to put at that other cornerback spot with Alford out? Do you put him on Gordon and then have the safety follow him, which we've seen, that's a tactic we've seen New England do and have success with. They did it, I believe, in one of the big playoff games last year, maybe in the AFC Championship, whatever it was, I don't remember, but I don't know which way you go with that. That might be a function of what other coverage principles you do. Also, they're not going to play man-to-man the whole time, and New England does play man-to-man. That's why they're able to do it. that way. New England did it last week. That's what I'm thinking of with Revis on Reggie Wayne. And then they had other guys doubling T.Y. Hilton. I don't know if Atlanta will do that on Gordon because I think we're going to see a few more zone concepts. They're going to mix their coverages, if I would guess.
Well, and somehow, some way, that Atlanta team is sitting atop the NFC South right now with a 4-6 record. But the inability to guard the pass, especially losing a starting cornerback, could mean the end of their chance at getting that division, right? Could it even one piece lead to a demise?
Maybe, but other teams have lost pieces too. The team that's challenging them for it, New Orleans, they just lost their wide receiver, Brandon Cooks. So that's almost the flip side of losing a cornerback for a few weeks. And the Brandon Cooks loss is world margins more significant than the Robert Alford loss. So I think injuries happen. Next man up, and the Falcons will have a next man up. What is key with that defense and all defenses, but especially Atlanta's, is if they can get something out of their pass rush somehow.
The New York Jets are coming off a bye. We think they're going to be playing on the road at the Buffalo Bills, but who knows if they can even play there based on all this snow, which is even more frustrating because we were going to have Jerry Hughes, which I was looking forward to that interview. He couldn't even make it to the practice facility. So
it was closed. They closed the facility on Wednesday.
So no interview.
We were going to talk to Hughes. I was going to talk to him Wednesday afternoon, but the Bills weren't open for business.
I saw that the Bills are asking fans to come shovel for $10 an hour.
I don't know how you shovel 6 to 8 feet of snow. I mean, obviously, some of that's going to be plowed and you shovel off the seats or whatever. I don't know. We're not,
it's insane.
We shouldn't be talking. We don't know what we're talking about here. There's a lot of snow. It might impact the game. As far as the things we know, Buffalo's offense, here you go. Buffalo's offense lately has been snowed under.
Yeah, Kyle Orton really needs to get things on track because that offense seems to kind of ride or die with Kyle Orton.
And he was way off track against Miami. I mean, there were some throws that a veteran QB ought to be able to recognize, some coverages that he just didn't see. He played like a rookie at times. I don't think you make a change. I don't think you go back to E.J. Manuel, who plays like a rookie at all
every
times.
Every week.
Yeah, but it was a little bit disheartening just to see because the Bills are all of a sudden they're 5-5 in a very good AFC this year. And it's disheartening because this is a team that's good enough to be a playoff team at some point. And you get the sense it's not going to happen if they keep doing this stuff.
Well, Miami was able to dictate that entire game on both sides of the ball.
That was Miami's game. Now the Jets, I don't think will be able to do that with their offense so much. And I know the Jets played very well against Pittsburgh a few weeks ago, but that offense did not dictate that game against Pittsburgh. They happened to make some plays at the right moments. They got a big 17-0 lead, and then Pittsburgh dictated the game. The Jets were behind. But Pittsburgh's defense was better than New York's offense that day after the first quarter, even before that at some point, for some points. So it's going to be a battle of defenses here. Both teams are defensive-minded teams, obviously. And it might come down to whichever team's offense makes that one play, the one or two plays that you need. And if that's the case, I'm taking Sammy Watkins because we've seen Buffalo do that with him this year. And we've seen he's the one guy. The Jets don't have someone you can manufacture offense around. They have a great gadget player in Percy Harvin and nothing else. Sammy Watkins is a guy you can manufacture your offense around. And if you need a play on third down and 15, you at least have a possibility there.
The Dolphins were able to get a great pass rush on the Bills, and I think that's what kind of hurt the Bills because that running game is obviously not there anymore with Fred Jackson and C.J. Spiller both struggling with those injuries. Do the Jets try to target the Bills in a similar way with that great front line?
They might, but they don't have Miami's weapons in the pass rush. I mean, they have very good trench players and Muhammad Wilkerson and Sheldon Richardson and Damon Harrison to a certain degree as well. They don't have any edge guys, though. Jason Babin hasn't been that for him. Calvin Pace is an edge setter, but not an edge turner or burner or however you want to look at it. So, I mean, what the Jets, if they want to pressure, they're going to have to bring a blitz of some design.
The Eagles this week are taking on a similar trench kind of guy in Jarrell Casey in that Tennessee Titans team. And Peter wrote in his Monday morning column this week that the Eagles last week just ran into a hot Packers team and there's nothing really to worry there about the defense. Do you agree with this?
Yeah,
from,
I do.
From the 24th ranked defense in the NFL?
I don't care where they're ranked necessarily. They're going to always be ranked a little bit higher because they face more plays on the field because their offense plays fast. So their numbers are always going to be a little bit inflated. I agree with – I watched the film and I agree with Peter. I think the Packers ran it, and they ran into a Packer team that can win one-on-one in a variety of spots, and the Packers do a great job of spreading out and forcing you into one-on-one situations. And last week, for example, it was Bradley Fletcher that had the faceplant game. He had his bad day, and he could not handle Jordy Nelson on multiple plays. There were other guys. The pass rush got nothing. That's a little bit concerning, but we haven't seen that be an issue in other weeks. In fact, it's been a very, very good pass rush at times. Connor Barwin, I think, is a Defensive Player of the Year candidate, and I would expect him to have a big game here, along with Trent Cole. They've got players on that defense. They just had a bad – he's right. They had a bad game.
So do you like the Eagles then in that division, in that
– Yeah, in the NFC East? Yeah. Yeah, I do. I think – I mean, the offense can manufacture its points in yardage, and I think the defense is a head and – not head and short, but it's a good few inches taller than Dallas's defense. It's better than Dallas's defense.
And Zach Mettenberger then quarterbacking that Tennessee Titans team now full-time. The Titans are just going to ride this out, right, and kind of see where they sit at the end of the season. Is that how you feel with
Mettenberger? That's what the Titans do every year with their quarterback. That's Tennessee football these days, John. That's Titans football. Mettenberger's a guy worth taking a glance at. I think we've seen that. I mean, some of the stuff we do, the way he bounces back from mistakes, and that's not the greatest thing, but that, I mean, to make the mistakes, you don't want to even be having that, but – look, rookies and a pocket passing rookie especially, they're going to make mistakes and if they're going to be fitting the balls through tight windows. And Mettenberger's a classic. He might be the most pockety pocket passer in the NFL right now. So you can design blitzes around him, and Philadelphia, I guarantee you, will do that.
Yeah, there's no mobility from him there in
no,
the pocket.
And so he's going to have to be a tight window passer and take some chances with the ball, and he has the arm to do it. He's got to quicken his motion a little bit. He's got a little bit of that Byron Leftwich syndrome in him. But I think they'll get that sharpened up. I think Wisenhunt and that staff will work with him on that. He's got to also learn to eliminate what's not open a little bit quicker, which is the case with almost all young players. They don't quite have a sense for that. But the pieces are there. I mean, we're talking about – these are the weaknesses, but we're talking about arm strength. We're talking about ability to read coverages and make decisions based on that. I think he can do some of these things. I don't know if this will be the week that he shows it, though, because he is a statue right now in the game. He's a little bit slow mentally through the game right now, naturally. And against a guy like that, an immobile quarterback, you want to bring interior pressure and get it right in his face because he's got nowhere to go. And Philadelphia is very good with that. They're one of the better double-A gap blitz teams in the league. And I wouldn't be surprised to see them bring a third blitzer through those A-gaps on a regular basis and bring one of those safeties.
I think it's interesting, too, that so often the mobility of quarterbacks, and not necessarily a running quarterback, but the ability to move in that pocket is forgotten in a quarterback's ability. And you look at that frequently with guys like Phillip Rivers, Peyton Manning, but, and Ben Roethlisberger.
There's two different things we're talking about. One is when you say mobility, that means, can he get around? Can he escape? Can he run around? And Mettenberger's got none of that. You and I can run as well as he can in that sense. But when you talk about pocket mobility, can you slide step? Can you move? Can you hitch up? Can you climb the pocket? Can you drift back a little if you need to? You almost never want to do that. But if you need to, can you get around in the pocket? And he's a little stiff in that even. And he's got some heavy feet, John. But the fundamentals are there, and that's something that can be worked on. And you don't need to be quick to do that. The quickness will come if you can learn what you're doing. It's very mechanic-based. And we've seen a great example. The best example is Peyton Manning.
Well, and these top-tier quarterbacks, too, they're not all running quarterbacks. Most of them aren't, but they all have that mobility factor.
We're talking about the whole league. Well, Rivers is like that. Stafford's a little bit like that.
Peyton's like that. Yep, Aaron Rodgers.
Brady's. Rodgers a little bit. Rodgers, I agree with you, but he's gotten a little bit less in that regard. He is so exceptionally talented. He's an exception to a lot of rules. Roethlisberger is as well. And both of them have gotten sharper. Roethlisberger later in his career, as we've talked about. Brady's very good at all this. Breeze, yeah, you're right. I mean, folks, this is good quarterbacking. You have to be able to operate within the pocket to be a good NFL quarterback.
Well, and Rodgers in that white-hot Packers offense, like we mentioned, are one of the most fun teams to watch this season. And they're on the road with a divisional opponent, Minnesota Vikings. And I think the more interesting story there, since that offense is functioning so well, is Clay Matthews' move to inside linebacker. And what have you seen from him in that second game since making a bit of a transition?
You know, he was all right. There wasn't anything that really stood out a whole bunch. He made some flash plays, but a lot of them actually came when he was on the edge in some sort. Like they put him on the edge in a passing situation or something like that, or he looped around, whatever it was. He plays fast, and he's been able to maintain that playing speed at the inside linebacker position, which leads me to believe that he'll be very good at that spot for the rest of the season if that's what they want to do. And I thought he looked fine against Philadelphia.
Did that move have completely to do with that 29th ranked run defense for the Packers?
A lot of it. They've been looking for answers at that position
since week one.
Yeah, I mean, Brad Jones, who I'm surprised hasn't stuck there because he's a good athlete, but for a variety of reasons that I'm sure Dom Capers could list for you and never will publicly. They don't like Brad Jones in that spot. They went with Lattimore for a little bit. They've tried all kinds of different guys there, and it didn't work, so they finally said, screw it, let's just put our best player there and move on. And also, this wouldn't happen if two other guys weren't playing really well that made them comfortable with this. And one is Nick Perry.
Julius Peppers.
Well, three other guys. Because
yeah.
I want to say, Peppers has been fine. But they don't move Peppers around as much. They do a little bit, I guess. But I was going to say Mike Neal as the other guy, because Neal is someone you can put up on the edge, but also put down on the line of scrimmage and have him be in a 3-point stance. He's in the A gaps at times. He's just been flexible for him. And with Perry and Neal on the field together, plus Peppers, like you said, and Matthews, that what they call their NASCAR front, it gives them options. And to take Matthews out of the quote unquote NASCAR formula and just slide him back to inside linebacker, you're still leaving those other guys on the field on every down, though. They're getting their best 11 on the field. That's what it is. And Mike Neal and Nick Perry are now part of that best 11.
But I think we would both agree that Clay Matthews relies on his quickness and his ability to move side to side, his lateral quickness as well. Why take a guy that's so great on the line of scrimmage farther away from it and delay his chance to get to the quarterback?
Well, they were already doing that a little bit anyway, because they were bringing him. Because one thing when you do that, John, is you also give him space to work with, and he has a running start. So, he's quick, but if he's quick and you're not touching him, that's scary. And so they were bringing him through the A-gaps to begin with. Not every play, certainly, and they're not doing it every play now. I mean, none of this stuff is absolute. You know, guys, we talk so much about base positions and who's at this linebacker and do they have a – you know, I don't even chart strong side and weak side linebackers anymore because defenses move around so much. Offenses move around a lot, and that changes. Tight ends, motion, and shift, and all of that changes what position you're playing on defense. So I wouldn't get too caught up in who's playing where. Matthews moving back to inside linebacker from the outside, yes, that is a significant change, but that doesn't change the integrity of the player. We're still talking about an elite football player, and they're going to be just fine. And he's had a sack in each game, I believe, since he moved inside linebacker.
And a guy that's also great at anticipating the play, too, with Clay Matthews.
Yeah, he is. He has a sense. Some guys just know how to play.
I think that's what I left off. That's what didn't maybe click, is because that anticipation doesn't mean, like, the delay isn't there from moving outside to inside.
Well, some guys just know how to play football. I mean, he's going to anticipate from whatever. And these Matthew boys, they know how to play football.
We mentioned earlier that the Cleveland Browns released Ben Tate. Now the Vikings have picked him up. So Adrian Peterson not coming back this week. I guess the Packers are thankful for that. But what have you seen from this Vikings offense in the last couple of weeks?
It's inconsistent. They have a young quarterback. And, you know, Peterson's not going to be back in any weeks. And we won't get into that or that discussion.
Thank goodness.
I think the running game's fine, though. I mean, obviously it's better if you have Adrian Peterson. But I don't know if we've – I'm sure we've said this at some point on the podcast. I like Jerick McKinnon. I think he gives him quickness. I think he can create his own space. I like that in a running back. And Ben Tate, by the way, cannot do that. And that's why I don't think he'll play ahead of McKinnon or Matt Asiata, who's their third down back now.
And when McKinnon catches the ball out of the backfield too, he's something special.
Yeah, he is. He has that, to me, that's a little bit that creating his own space. You can get him the ball in space even better, like what you're kind of alluding to. I watched a Vikings game on television last week. But one thing you do get, as you've told me, John, when on television versus on film, you do get a little better sense of the flow of an offense, or just the chemistry of an offense,
Pace,
I'll take the film over TV any week, but I can't see every game on film, so some I have to just settle for TV on Sundays. And watching them on offense, they don't have any kind of rhythm at all in the passing game. And I was really surprised. One thing Norv Turner said to whoever is doing the game on Fox, I think it was Rondé Barber and Chris Myers, who was a pretty good – that's a pretty good announcing crew, by the way.
It is, yeah.
He said that Jarius Wright's their fastest wide receiver, which to me I interpreted almost a little bit as him saying – and I don't know Norv Turner very well. I don't know if he plays these kind of games. But it almost sounded to me like he's saying Cordarrelle Patterson's not our fastest receiver.
Norv Turner plays games all the time. Remember that earlier in the offseason, too, when he said this was his best quarterback group he'd ever coached?
Yeah, that's right.
And then Philip Rivers started putting up MVP numbers.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's not. Teddy Bridgewater's got a ways to go, and there's just a dink and dunk element to the offense. There's not a lot. Look, Bridgewater can let it rip at the intermediate levels at times. He doesn't have a cannon of an arm, but he's willing to make the throws. But it's not. There's no play-to-play consistency with him. You don't get a sense that the offensive concepts build on each other. And where he's been at his best has been like quick screens and stuff like that, stuff that's easy or very, very defined for him, which is fine. That's how rookies play. But you just asked me how the offense is right now. That's how it is. And, oh, by the way, Matt Khalil can't block anybody.
I was just going to say that. How much of this has to do with that offensive line, especially with Khalil?
He's been awful. I don't know what to say. I mean, he's been absolutely awful. I know I don't know what else to say. I mean,
Fair enough. He sums it up pretty well.
Look, he was – remember we talked a few weeks ago about Michael Clayton for the Bucks?
Yeah.
And how some guys are just great as rookies and then they disappear? And that's Matt Khalil. He had a good rookie season, a borderline Pro Bowler, and now he's not any good at all. I mean, he's a weakness, a liability for him.
Another one of those teams that is struggling on the offensive line has been all year. The Chargers are taking on a great pass rush in the St. Louis Rams, and this could be tough for the Chargers too because you're facing an attack from all angles when it comes to the Rams.
You know, I'm going to take a little bit of umbrage with your intro there.
Okay.
I don't like it. I think they have been – I think they don't have very good players or individuals on that offensive line and guys – who over the course of their careers have not been great, but watching them play together, I think they're doing fine there. I think they have been all right.
Well, there's just been a shuffle of personnel too. The center position has been all over the place.
Yeah, but they have Rich Ornberger in there, who's a guy I like. Yep. He is one of the nastiest. I would not want to play against him. He'll do whatever. You watch him, and the whistle blows. He waits till the echo of the whistle goes away before he stops doing whatever it is he wants to do to you. I like Ornberger. I thought he was great down the stretch for them last year when he was in. He's not Nick Hardwick, but I think he works. I think Reinhardt's been fine left guard. King Dunlap's the guy I'm really alluding to, though, when I say that these guys have been better. They haven't. That Dunlap has not had a great career, but he's having a pretty stellar season for them. And some of the issues we've seen before with him, like bending at the waist and inconsistent mechanics, that's largely gone away this year.
So then what do you attribute that to, that change?
I think you give credit to two – first of all, credit to the players, all right? King Dunlap. I mean, he's the guy on the field. He's responsible for his performance. He's improved it. That he gets the most credit. But he's been helped by the coaching staff on two fronts. Mike McCoury's staff, I think one my guess is – I don't know him. I've never met him. But Joe DeAlessandris, their offensive line coach, who, by the way, is from Aliquippa, Pennsylvania. Everybody's from Aliquippa in the NFL, feels like. And they've got so many –
Isn't that where Ditka's from?
It is. And Darrell Revis and Tony Dorsett. And, I'm blanking on some of the – there's a list, though. There's a long list. And the town only has, like, 10,000 people in it.
And they all
play
NFL-caliber football.
Yeah. Or they coach it, in this guy's case.
That's right.
And so I think I'd like to meet him because I think he's probably doing a very good job with these guys, especially considering how much they're shuffling the guys around, like you said, or having to put new guys in. He's having to work with DJ Fluker. A rookie who needs to get better against bull rushes, even though he's a big man, but he's very good when he's the one bowling. Also, the scheme, though, is helping him. Mike McCoy, coaching from a schematic standpoint, they've done very good stuff with their three-step timing offense. And when you do three-step timing, the offensive line is protected because it's hard to blow something in three steps. You're not going to get beat very often in three steps. And you start getting more confident, I think, that way.
And you said Fluker was a rookie. I think you realize that he's a second-year guy. But that line is now going up against Robert Quinn, which we talked about him a little bit earlier in this show. He's a mess for any offensive line, regardless of the person.
Oh yeah, he's the best defensive end in the league, and it's I mean, if we're not counting J.J. Watt, you know, he's the best 4-3 defensive end. and it's not even close who the next best edge rusher is. But really with this Rams defense out there facing, you know, they just we talked about them and how they played the Broncos. They've got guys that are playing extremely good football on the back end for them. Two guys in particular, young guys.
Young corners, yeah.
Well, and between the corners, though. I mean, E.J. Gaines is playing well. I think Jenkins has been okay at the other cornerback. But I want to say T.J. McDonald at strong safety, for one, is lanky, long. He's getting smarter. He's fast. He's rangy. He's a very eager hitter. And the other guy is Ogletree, the rookie from a year ago, who is – we knew the talent was there, big-time talent. And we all wondered when will he, you know, apply it. And not that he wasn't, but, like, when will he harness it? And we're starting to see him harness it now. In coverage and in run support, he's having – he McDonald and Ogletree have been as good as any two-player tandems, any tandem in the past month as anybody in the NFL.
Looking at how young that secondary is, too, with LaMarcus Joyner out there, E.J. Gaines, Marcus Robertson, like you alluded to there, how are they able to – hang with teams like Denver, like San Francisco, winning these games against championship-level teams from a year ago?
Well, it's an extremely talented group. Pure talent-wise, it might be the best defense in the league, pure talent-wise. Now, they're not at Miami's level, in my opinion, or a lot of other teams, because these guys, while they're harnessing it, they still have a ways to go, and there's some consistency factor to be included there. But Greg Williams is doing a good job with them, and he puts a lot on their plate. He asks a lot of them. And early in the year, we saw them play reactionary, and they looked overwhelmed at times. We're not seeing that as much now. They're starting to play faster. They're starting to dictate. And that's the way Greg Williams has always played. He's been the aggressor. He's a lot like Jim Haslett in that sense.
The one win Jaguars this week on the road against the Colts, and these two teams met already. And Andrew Luck was damn near unstoppable in this win, throwing for four touchdowns. Do you expect this to be a similar result again this week?
I think so, because something that teams have done against Jacksonville, for one, Indy's a better team than Jacksonville. So Andrew Luck can throw four. I mean, theoretically, he can get four touchdowns against them. But I've been concerned that so many teams have had great route combinations designed specifically to beat Jacksonville's coverages, specifically Jacksonville's single high zone coverages, their base cover three concepts, the stuff that Gus Bradley brought over from Seattle. We've seen – that's what the Colts did in the previous matchup. They had six or seven just dynamite cover three beaters. That if you have a cover three beater against cover three, you're going to win every time. I mean, as long as you execute it. When we say cover three beater, that means the guy is designed to be open and there's no physical possibility of the defenders on the back end taking it away if it's a route designed specifically to beat that coverage. And an example of a cover three beater, something like, and we saw Kobe Fleener do this, it's something like a corner route against cover three with a deep route to the side. So basically the wide receiver lifts the cornerback, goes deep, and then a tight end runs a corner route underneath that. There's nobody there because the cornerback ran with the wide receiver. That kind of stuff and variations of that we see a lot against cover three, and teams have done a good job of getting to it against Jacksonville and Indianapolis especially. And that's concerning to me that Jacksonville hasn't found a way, either through tactical adjustments or through better execution up front, whatever it is, they haven't found a way to combat that. And we've seen other teams do this against them as well.
Is Vontae Davis on the Colts defensive side still playing at the high level that you noticed early on this season?
Yes. Yeah, he's been very good. I mean, no cornerback is going to give up zero passes, especially when they ask you to play man-to-man off there with no safety help. But Davis is the guy that comes very close to that. He's been good in that way. And, you know, speaking of man-to-man, Jacksonville did try that. I don't mean to jump back to the other side of the ball here, but I was thinking about Dallas and the Dallas game in London 2 weeks ago, and now Jacksonville's coming off the bye after that. Jacksonville did try to do some man-to-man stuff against Dallas, and the Cowboys beat those situations too. And that's where Dez Bryant killed them in the second quarter, working against Dwayne Gratz, where they got him in isolation. So I think what the issue is it's easy for me to sit here and say, well, the coach has got to find a way to make a change or getting beat on cover three stuff. If you don't have the players at certain spots, it can be tough. And I'm not as high on Jacksonville's secondary this year as I was at this time last year or heading into this year.
Well, and those personnel challenges are – exactly what the Tampa Bay Buccaneers and Chicago Bears have both faced this season. And the Bucs are on the road at the Bears. Jay Cutler coming off a very needed win there for Chicago. And Lovie Smith coming back to Soldier Field. Do you think his experience helps the Bears in any way this Sunday?
His experience as being the Bears coach, you mean?
Yeah.
You know, I kind of do. Because normally I'd say, no, it doesn't matter, you know, but Lovie Smith was there a while, and a lot of these same players were there, and specifically Jay Cutler was there. And he knows what Cutler doesn't like. And he knows, as a coach, what gave him trouble when he was trying to win with a lot of those guys. So, I could see it being – I'm interested to see if they do anything different against them, against Jay Cutler.
Well, in the Bucs, regardless of who they play, Mike Evans the last few games, having over 100 yards receiving in each of those games – He's been impossible to cover whoever they're playing.
I'm starting to think you're right about him.
Oh, yeah, when I liked him right off the
bat. Yeah, and I told you how I wasn't, you know, I had mixed emotions after watching
Washington's
film.
Big body and speed, man.
Yeah.
There's not a whole lot not to like.
Yeah, and he does control his body real well. I don't know who guards him for Chicago. I mean, I don't know. Who are you going to put on? I mean, because the problem, it's the height that makes this unique. And this used to be the case with Vincent Jackson, who's kind of disappeared, by the way, this year. I have not been high on him at all this year. But it's who do you put on a guy? Because, like, the Bears have a good – I'm thinking of Tim Jennings, for example, who I think is a good cornerback. Problem is Jennings is, what, 5'10", 5'11"?
And Kyle Fuller's little, too.
Is he?
Yeah.
What's Fuller's? I'm going to look up Fuller's
Kyle
size.
Okay, Kyle Fuller is 6 feet tall. So just,
well, that's little when you're going up against 6'5".
Yeah, that's
and 6'5" with a wingspan that's probably about 6'10", 6'11" of a guy. So that's the great, and this will always be the case. This is why Mike Evans was the number 7 pick in the draft. Something else that Tampa Bay is starting to do with him a little more, and they did this against Washington on that play I talked about where they beat Perry Riley for the touchdown. And they'll have a chance to do this against Chicago too because, like the Redskins, the Bears play nickel instead of dime. So they're going to keep an extra linebacker on the field, but they put Evans in the slot on the trip side of the formation. So he's lining up very close to the formation. And when you do that, you give Evans the entire field to work with for one, because he can go left or right, because he's basically a tight end detached from the formation. And you get him on safeties and linebackers because those are the defenders who are inside. And the Bears, I think, will be vulnerable to that at some point. And the Bucs have done a good job with that. They clearly are committing that formation because the last two games they've played, Austin Seferian Jenkins, their tight end, has been split out on the X as the X ISO a few times, which is not his style
of
game.
Very rare, too, isn't it?
What's that?
To have the tight end kind of on that X ISO is rare.
More teams are doing it, though. It's becoming less rare. You're right, it is rare. But we see Denver do it with Julius Thomas. The Saints could do it with Graham if they want, and I'm sure they have. The Niners do it with Vernon Davis once in a while. But Seferian Jenkins is not a guy you do that with. All those other guys we just listed are matchup nightmares. Seferian Jenkins is a good inline type tight end. He's a big body guy. But why they do it is because they get their other big guy, Mike Jenkins, in the slot. Chicago Bears have also done this with their big wide receivers.
And with Alshon.
Yeah, I remember against and Brandon Marshall both.
Of course.
I remember against Cleveland last year, the Bears put Kellen Davis as the X ISO receiver on first down. And they were against the Browns' base defense. And so what that meant was the Browns had their cornerbacks still on the outside because they weren't matching up. They were just in their base. And so they had Kellen Davis on Joe Hayden. Now, obviously, Kellen Davis is not getting the ball in that scenario, but someone else is. And there's no Joe Hayden left to guard those other guys. The Bucs can dictate those kind of matchups against the Bears. And by the way, the Bears don't have anyone in Joe Hayden's class to begin with anyway.
What I think is funny is that we were criticizing the Bears corners who are 6 feet and 5'11", when that's kind of typical for cornerbacks.
Yeah.
The only cornerback in this league height-wise that I think can contend with a Mike Evans is like Sean Smith in Kansas City, who's 6'3".
Yeah, maybe Brandon Brown or 6'4".
We like him. I remember watching that game with you, and you're like, Sean Smith is huge.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we watched it when you watched it. We came over. You came
it
over
was
the
an
Patriots.
Honor. It was an honor.
Yeah, Patriots-Chiefs game. I've always liked Sean Smith. He's huge with long arms. I would pay to watch Sean Smith play against Mike Evans. I'd like that. Yeah, but the stuff we said about the Bears, you're right. We could say that about any cornerbacking tandem.
And that's what makes Mike Evans so valuable. All right, we'll wrap up here with this Monday night game. Baltimore Ravens New Orleans Saints. The Saints 4-6, not looking invincible at home like they used to. 3-2 record there in the dome, including two home losses in a row. What's going on with this offense?
Well, New Orleans, like I said, they couldn't earlier in the show. They couldn't finish drives against Cincinnati. Their running game, they had to abandon it last week. I don't know if they had to, because the game wasn't a blowout against the Bengals. It wound up being lopsided, but it wasn't. That's not how the game flowed. But they didn't have any balance from the running game last week. They were forced to sustain drives and dink and dunk almost. If you can take away the Saints' three-level stretch concepts, where they have a post and a crossing route and another form of a post or another crossing route, whatever it is, three levels of guys crossing the field, if you can take that away and defend them between the numbers, it's somewhat of a limited passing game, because they don't necessarily have guys who can win one-on-one on the outside. And now you remove Brandon Cooks from this equation. I think that's a huge loss for them, because besides playmaking talent alone, and he's probably their fastest guy, he was their only true east and west, you know, horizontal presence. And he gave them, you could build plays around that. You could build designs. You got more leverage. He gave them that dimension. That's gone now. This is strictly a north and south offense, which might sound good, but it's hard to get open and find guys to get open with just north and south concepts.
I remember after watching the Packer game and the Carolina Panthers game for the Saints and seeing the numbers put up by Mark Ingram and thinking, okay, so this offense will ride with the success of the running game. But then 120 yards on the ground for him against San Francisco, they lose, and then he's fairly absent against Cincinnati with just 67 yards.
Did he have 67?
67 on 23 carries, yeah.
That was a very quiet 67.
Well, when you're averaging less than 3 yards a carry.
Yeah, I guess you're right, 23 carries, yeah. And Pecco and Maluga took away a lot of the runs. They had a great game. A few weeks ago, I wrote Mark Ingram would be a 1,200-yard back for somebody. And I don't know if I quite – I do feel that way still, but I don't think
it's
this team
future?
Right now.
Yeah, I'm not saying this year.
I'm saying he's that kind of a talent. And you're right, that running game has not been a state – even against San Francisco, you didn't get the sense that it was
– I mean, yeah, 27, a lot of carries there, 4.4 yards a carry. It's not jumping out at you.
Yeah, they rode him a lot, but I don't – I'm trying to go back in my mind and remember the game, and all I remember is Chris Borland making plays – and run defense.
Probably the reason he had 18 tackles.
Yeah, I don't feel like New Orleans has dictated the flow of games with their running game, and I don't think this would be the week to start either. Baltimore's a team you attack through the air. I think you do it quickly. You're not going to run against Haloti Ngata on Brandon Williams.
And one of the reasons for that, as we've talked about, the loss of Jimmy Smith is big for the Ravens, right? Is it starting to present itself as more of a problem?
You know, it's actually not yet, because they're coming off a bye, and then their previous game against Tennessee, that was one of the most lopsided games we've seen in a long time. I think Tennessee had 7-3 and outs almost all in a row. I mean, it was just Tennessee had no offense against them, and a big reason why was their new corners. You know, there wasn't just Jimmy Smith that left. They also released Dominique Franks and Chalky Brown, and they brought in promoted Anthony Levine and brought in Danny Guerrero, and those guys were fabulous against Tennessee, Guerrero especially. So, no, it hasn't been an issue yet. Now, did they catch lightning in a bottle that week? Was it just the one? You know, we'll see. There's a reason that those guys were where they were at early in the season as well. I mean, we're not talking about upper echelon talent. At some point, the loss of Graham will hurt them, and maybe we will see that Jimmy Smith, I mean, will hurt them. And maybe I'm thinking Jimmy Graham because of the New Orleans factor. We might see it this week, because I think Smith would have been a very good matchup on Marquise Colston.
With the success of the Cleveland Browns over these last few weeks and Pittsburgh Steelers starting to get things back on track week to week, they're not real consistent either. Are the Ravens still your favorite team in the AFC North? Because you thought that they were the most well-rounded team.
Yeah, but I think I thought there's a domino effect of the Jimmy Smith injury, not just that they lost him, who I thought he was first team all pro caliber before that, based on how he was playing this year. I think he's having his best year. I have to see. Ask me after this game, because I think this will be a good test for them.
Well, and that's all we have for you this week. Remember to subscribe to the podcast, MMQB Podcast, on iTunes. You'll find the podcast in your inbox every single Thursday morning. From Andy, I'm John, and we'll see you next week.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.